بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. السلام عليكم and welcome. The title advertised was The Amazing Quran. I would suggest, first of all, that to call the Quran amazing is something that isn't done simply by Muslims, who may have an appreciation for the Quran and are very pleased with it. But the book has been called amazing by non-Muslims. Non-Muslims, in fact, people who are very filled with dislike for Islam, have still been surprised at the Quran. They've been amazed at what it has to say. So that is some of what I wanted to talk about. One thing that surprises the non-Muslim, those who are examining the book very carefully, is that the Quran does not appear to be what they would expect. What they know is they have an old book. It comes from 14 centuries ago in the Arabian desert. So they expect that the book should look something like that. It should look like an old book from the desert. And then they find out that it doesn't resemble what they expect. One of the first things that some people notice is that if you have a book that's old and it comes from the desert, it should talk about the desert. And the Quran does. Some of its imagery concerns the desert. But it also talks about the sea, what it's like to be in a storm on the sea. In fact, some years ago, the story came to us in Toronto of a man who was in the Merchant Marine. So he made his living on the ocean, and somebody gave him a copy of the Quran to read. A Muslim gave him a translation to read. He knew nothing about the history of Islam, but he was interested. When he finished reading the book, he brought it back to the Muslim who gave it to him, and he said, this Muhammad, was he a sailor? Because he was impressed at how it described so perfectly a storm on the sea. When he was told no, as a matter of fact, he lived in the desert, this was enough for the man. He embraced Islam on the spot. He was so impressed. Because he'd been in a storm. He knew that who wrote this has been in a storm on the ocean. Because of the description of waves within waves and the darkness between them, the precise description. It's not what somebody imagines a storm is like on the ocean, it's what somebody knows a storm is like on the ocean. So, this is one indication of the kind of thing I'm getting at, that the book doesn't seem to be tied to a certain time and place from the desert 14 centuries ago. The scientific ideas expressed also don't seem to originate from 14 centuries ago. Many centuries before that, there was a theory well known of atomism, which was advanced by the Greeks. Democritus in particular was a man's name who lived about 23 centuries ago. Democritus and the people who came after him assumed that matter comes in a smallest piece, the atom. The Arabs used to deal in that same concept, and the word in Arabic, zarra, an atom, commonly meant that. It's the smallest piece of matter. Now, modern science finds out that, yes, there is an atom, there's the smallest unit of matter, which still has the same characteristics as the element, but that atom comes apart too. That was a new idea. That's a development of this last century. Interestingly enough, that doesn't outdate the Quran, because we have an interesting statement which is usually missed in any translation of the Quran. In an ayah that mentions the tiniest pieces of things, and it mentions this dharra, saying an atom or anything smaller than an atom. Now, 14 centuries ago, that sentence would look unusual even to an Arab, because to him, a dharra, well, that was the bottom. That's the smallest things get. The Quran mentions that, in fact, Allah is aware of everything down to the dharra and anything smaller. So the book is not outdated. Another example of what we might expect to find in an old book is what you will find in virtually any old book that comes near to the subject of health or medicine. Various historical sources tell us that the Prophet of Islam was very concerned with health and hygiene, very concerned with cleanliness. That was his reputation. So you would think that if you have a book which originates in his head, it should talk about medicine. That if you have this disease, you should try this. If this makes you ill, try some of this. Because history reports he had a lot of opinions on the subject. He had a lot of ideas about if this is your disease, this might be your cure. He had a lot of opinions that way. But none of them are in the Quran. There's no home remedies in the Quran that could be outdated. In fact, the Quran only mentions one item, which is not in dispute by anybody. It mentions honey, saying that in honey there's a healing. Something there is that's good in honey. I don't think anyone will argue with that. But it does not contain any of a man's opinions about what is beneficial, what's the best food to eat, or what is healthiest for you, what will cure this or that disease. Another item that you... Can we turn this down just a little bit? Another item that you might also expect to find, if you assume this book is the product of a man's mind, is it should reflect some of what is going on in his mind. In fact, if you look up in certain encyclopedias, various books, the subject of Islam, many books will tell you that the Quran was a product of the hallucinations that this man had. Well, if that's true, if it originated in some psychological problems going on in his mind, it should look like that. But does it? What kinds of things do you suppose went on in his mind and his heart? He had a very difficult life. He had three sons who died as infants. All of his daughters except one died before him. He had a wife of several years who must have been quite a woman. Because in fact, when the first revelation came to him, he ran home to his wife, afraid. I suggest to you that even today, you have a hard time finding an Arab who will tell you, "I was so afraid I ran home to my wife." Won't be likely to say that. But that's how influential and strong a woman she apparently was. She died. Does the Quran mention any of these things? The death of his children, his wife? Never. Never discusses these things. And yet they must have been the things that hurt him and tortured him, caused him pain and grief through his whole life. They never show up in this book which is supposed to originate in his tortured mind. So I've just given so far some examples of how the Quran contains what you don't expect it to contain, and it's missing what you might expect should be there. A really scientific approach to the Quran is possible because the Quran offers something that is not offered by religious scriptures, generally speaking. Religions don't offer this. It's what the scientist demands. Let me explain to you what I mean. You see, today there are any number of people who have ideas about how the universe works. They have theories. You could find them all over the place. But the scientific community doesn't even bother to listen to them. Why? Because within the last century, the scientific community has demanded one thing. They say, if you have a theory, don't bother me with it unless you bring with that theory a way to prove that you are wrong, a test of falsification. Otherwise, don't bother me. That's why the scientific community listened to Einstein toward the beginning of this century, because he came with a new theory. He says, I think the universe works like this, and here are three ways to prove that I'm wrong. So the scientific community listened. They subjected it to the test. Within 6 years, he passed the tests which he offered. It doesn't prove he's right, but it proves he deserves to be listened to. Because he said, this is my idea, and in fact, try this. You want to prove I'm wrong? Here, do this. That's what the Quran has, falsification tests. Some that are old, some that exist till today. Because it makes statements saying, if this book is not what it claims to be, then all you have to do is this or this or this to prove that it's false. It offers falsification. I'd suggest to you, maybe the next time you get into some kind of a dispute with somebody about Islam, and he's claiming he has the truth and you are in the darkness, that might be the first thing that you suggest. To tell him, is there something in your religion which, if I could show it to you, would prove you're wrong? Is there anything? Because I can promise you, people won't have anything. They don't carry around that idea that I should not only present what I believe, but I should offer a man a chance to prove me wrong. But Islam does that. The Quran says, this is the truth, and to prove that it isn't, try this, or this, or this. As examples of that, you have what was to me the most surprising verse that I read in the Quran, when I first read through it, in the fourth surah, the 82nd ayah, where it says, have they not carefully considered the Quran? If it came from other than Allah, surely they would find in it many inconsistencies. Now that is a challenge to the unbeliever. Saying to the unbeliever, you say this book is not a revelation, then of course you will show me a mistake in the book, won't you? It surprised me because that's not really even human nature to write like that. We don't take an exam in school, and when we finish the exam, we write a note to the teacher saying, this exam is perfect. There are no mistakes in it. Find one if you can. We don't do that. The teacher won't sleep until he finds a mistake. And yet, that's the way the Quran comes. It says, this is true. In fact, if you don't think it's true, then all you have to do is show an inconsistency where it says this, but it says that, and it contradicts itself. It should contain many of those things, shouldn't it? So find one. But more about that later on. That's one example of this kind of thing of offering a falsification test. Maybe more interesting to you today is that there's another attitude that comes out in the Quran over and over, and that is advice to the reader. It tells the reader about different facts, and then it gives the advice saying, if you want to know more about this, or if you doubt what is said here, then ask the man who knows. Ask the men of ilm. The literal expression in Arabic means today the scientist. Because if you don't believe it, ask the man whose specialty this is. Ask the man who knows these things. He will tell you this is true. That too is a surprising attitude. To have a book that comes from somebody without training in these things, but when he talks about geography or botany, biology, whatever his subject, he mentions something and then says, if you doubt it, go ask the man. Ask the man who knows this thing. He'll tell you this is true. In every age, there have been Muslims who have followed that advice and made some surprising discoveries. If you look to the Muslim scientists of so many centuries ago, you'll find that their works are full of quotations from the Quran. They will tell you that they did research in such and such a place, they looked for something, and they tell you, the reason I looked there for this thing is because the Quran says such and so. It told me this is a good place to look. It pointed me in this direction, and I found this. The Quran says, for example, about the origin of man. It mentions in one place about where man comes from, and then it says to the reader, research it. Gives you a bare hint of the origin of man, and then it says to you, you should find out more about this. You should research it, and it gives you a hint where to look. That's the kind of thing that Muslims today largely, it seems, overlook, but not always. A few years ago, a group of brothers in Riyadh, in Saudi Arabia, collected all of the verses in the Quran that talk about the growth of the human being in the womb, embryology. They took the advice of the Quran, asked the man who knows. So they wanted to find out, is what the Quran says? What is the truth? And so they asked the man who knows. They chose, as it happened, a man who is professor of embryology at the University of Toronto in my city, not a Muslim. His name is Keith Moore. He's the author of textbooks on embryology. He knows. He's a world expert in embryology. So they invited him to Riyadh. They said, this is what the Quran says about your subject. Is it true? What can you tell us? They gave him all the help that he needed in translation, all the cooperation that he asked for. And he was so surprised at what he found that he changed his textbooks. You'll find, in fact, as I say, one of his textbooks is called Before We Are Born. As of the second edition of that textbook, in the history of embryology, he includes some material that wasn't in the first one because of what he found out the Quran says, that it was ahead of its time. People knew what other people didn't know, if they believed the Quran, all those centuries ago. I had the pleasure just about a week ago of interviewing him for a television presentation. We talked a great deal about this. It was illustrated by slides and so on. He mentioned that, in fact, some of the things that the Quran said about the growth of the human being weren't known until 30 years ago. In fact, one item, he said, was new to him. But he checked on it. It was true. So he added it to his book. That in particular had to do with the description of the embryo. What is its appearance? When he read the description in the Quran, he thought about it. He said, it's when it describes the human being that at one stage it resembles alaka, a leech-like clot. He said, I'd never thought of that before, but he went to the zoology department and asked for a picture of a leech, and it looks like the embryo. So he put both pictures in one of his textbooks. He has another one on clinical embryology. When he presented this information last fall in Toronto, it caused quite a lot of stir across Canada. It was reported in the newspapers. It was on the front page of many newspapers across Canada with some funny headlines, but people don't clearly understand what it's all about, I guess. One headline said, was it surprising things found in ancient prayer book, something like this. But one newspaper reporter asked the professor, they said, don't you think maybe the Arabs might have known about these things? The description of the embryo, its appearance, and how it changes and grows. Maybe because they weren't scientists, but maybe they did some crude dissections. They carved up people and examined these things. So the professor had to point out to them that the man had missed a very important point in all the discussion. All the slides that he projected for us, all the pictures he showed us of the embryo were taken through a microscope. He said, it doesn't matter if somebody used to try to discover embryology 14 centuries ago, they couldn't see it. Because all of this appearance of the embryo described in the Quran is when the item is still too small to see with your eye. You need a microscope to see it. Now, the microscope has only been around for a little more than 200 years. So he also suggested, he said, if you believe that maybe 14 centuries ago somebody had a microscope and he did this research and they made no mistakes, and then they somehow talked this man into putting it in his book, saying, this is true, trust me, put it in your book. Then they destroyed their equipment, kept it a secret that they ever had a microscope. He says, if you believe that, be my guest. He said, but you really shouldn't say that unless you bring some proof, because it's so ridiculous. In fact, when he was asked, how do you explain this information in the Quran? How did it get there? His explanation was, it can only be revealed. Now, that's a non-Muslim, but a man who knows. That's all he has to say. One of his colleagues, his name is Marshall Johnson at the University of Toronto, is in a related field to embryology, but he became so interested in how what the Quran said guided the Professor Moore to some interesting ideas that he asked the Muslims to collect for him everything they could on another subject. I want to see if it would lead them to anything. As a hobby. His hobby is geology. So he asked, would you collect everything the Quran says about geology, that is the structure of the earth? He wanted to see where it might take him. Because some people have been very surprised in that regard. In fact, there's a man from Yemen, Sheikh Zindani is his name, who has a very effective way of delivering Islam to people. He doesn't tell them that's what he's trying to do, but he collects things like this. He went to a man, a British man, who was a professor of geophysics, that is the construction of the earth. The man was also an atheist, as it happens, and had written some on atheism. But he asked him, he said, if the earth opened up and swallowed me, what would I see? And this professor said, that's a good question. And he gave him quite an explanation. He said, inside the earth you would find such and such and so. And when he had finished his description, the sheikh passed to him a translation of the Quran and said, would you read that verse? Because there's an ayah where it talks about some of those who opposed Musa. It says, if the earth was opened and swallowed them, they would see such and such and so. And here was the description the man had just given. He was so surprised that he accepted Islam on the spot. This, in fact, is on a tape recording of a talk that Sheikh Zindani made. He had the tape recorder running in the man's office to bear witness. Here's the man, here's what he said. In any case, don't be misled in what I'm getting at here. I'm not trying to prove to you that the Quran is a revelation by telling you these things. What I'm talking about here is an attitude that's in the Quran that you won't find anywhere else. Because the Quran does a very interesting thing. When it gives information like this, it often tells the reader, you didn't know this before. Now, there's no scripture that anybody has that I know of that says things like that. There are ancient writings and scriptures that many people have, and they give a lot of information, but they tell you where the information came from. You have the ancient history of the Bible, for example. And when it tells you this king lived here, and this one fought in this battle, and he had so many sons, then it tells you, if you want more information, read the book of so-and-so, because that's where this came from. It tells you where the information came from. But the Quran says, in many cases, here is information which you didn't have before, but check on it. You'll see that it's true. It's interesting that that was never challenged by the non-Muslims 14 centuries ago. The Meccans hated the Muslims. And time and again, they would hear this kind of thing. They'd hear some piece of information, and then part of the revelation says, you didn't know this before now. Now the Meccans never spoke up and said, that's not true. I know where he got that. We learned it in school when we were children. It really was new. And the Muslims followed the advice given here. It said, if you doubt it, check. Check if you don't doubt it. So it was that when Omar was the caliph, he chose a group of men and said, go find the wall of Dhulqarnain. The Arabs had never heard of it before, but the Quran tells you what it looks like and where you find it. So Omar said, you, go find it and report back. It should be in such and such a place. When you get there, it should look like this, and so on. So they went off to find it. It's in what is now called Durban in the Soviet Union. Now again, my point here is that the Quran may be accurate about a lot of things, but accuracy does not mean that a book is a revelation. What it means is you have a problem. It means you should find some explanation for where did this information come from. But an accurate book is not necessarily a divine book. The telephone book is probably accurate. It doesn't mean it's a revelation. But the point is to work the other direction. If you find a mistake, then you disqualify something. And that's what the Quran encourages. There was a man who came to me after a lecture in South Africa last year, and he was very angry about some of the things I had to say. He said, "I'm going home tonight and I'm going to find a mistake in the Quran." I said, "Congratulations, that's the most intelligent thing you've said." That's what you want to tell somebody to do, because the book offers the same challenge. Says, do you think this is not what it says it is? Then try this, try this. It's supposed to make you look. It's not a book that is delivered as though you are commanded to believe it. Now read it. It's supposed to work the other way. You read it and you come to believe it because you can't disqualify it. It earns your respect because you cannot find a disqualification. Now again, I have to stress, just because you can't explain something doesn't mean that you can take the first explanation somebody offers. You see, you may have some religious groups who will tell you, look, we had a miracle last night. A man came to us, he couldn't walk, and we said some words, and he got up and he walked. How do you explain that? And if you say, I can't, they say, ah, you see, I have the true religion. It's the power of God. Maybe, maybe not. Just because you can't explain it doesn't mean you have to accept his explanation. The same goes for the Quran. If you find something remarkable and surprising in there, just because you can't explain it doesn't mean that you have to believe it's a revelation. That's your business. But it shows the difficulty that people have if they say, I don't believe it. The Quran points out that these people have an obligation to find an explanation then. In fact, it mentions one man in an ayah, which I have always seen mistranslated into English at least. It talks about a man who heard the truth explained to him, and then it says why he was guilty. It says he got up and left and he didn't check on what he heard. Because you're guilty. If you hear something but you don't check to make sure it's true, you're guilty. That's a crime. You're supposed to process the information to decide which is the garbage to throw out, which is the good to keep. But you can't just let it come in and rattle around in your head. You're supposed to put it into the proper category. Is it true? Is it false? Is it still speculation? Maybe true, maybe false, but I don't know. Put it in these categories. The real certainty, that is the confidence that comes in the Quran, comes from a different approach. The certainty in acceptance of the Quran comes from exhausting the alternatives. To explain it this way, the book says it is a revelation. If you don't believe that, what is it? You have to come up with some explanation. You have a book. It's paper and ink. Where did it come from? It says it's a revelation. If it isn't, then where did it come from? You have to have some explanation. And the interesting thing is, no one has come up with an explanation that works. And in fact, the alternatives have been exhausted. Because they basically reduce to this, and it's been well established by non-Muslims. They'll tell you, well, the book, if it wasn't a revelation, either that man deceived everyone, or somebody deceived him. Either he fooled people or somebody fooled him, one or the other. That's what the non-Muslim says. And they do an interesting thing. They fall into two schools, insisting on one or the other. You have a large group of people who have researched it for hundreds of years, and they'll tell you one thing we know for sure, that man, Muhammad, he thought he was a prophet. He was crazy. Except for Allah. But they're convinced that he was fooled somehow. Another group will tell you, because of this evidence, one thing we know for sure, that man was a liar. He fooled everyone. These two groups never seem to get together. In fact, if you look up many references on Islam, usually a reference will tell you both. They may start by telling you the man was crazy, and they finish by telling you he was a liar. They never seem to realize you can't be both. If you are deluded, if you think you are a prophet, then you don't sit up late at night trying to figure out how will I fool people tomorrow so they'll think I'm a prophet. In fact, a great deal of the Quran came in answer to questions. Somebody would ask the man a question, and the revelation would come with the answer. You see, if you are deluded, you think that an angel puts words in your ear, then when somebody asks you a question, you think the angel will give you the answer. You're crazy. You think that. You don't tell somebody, wait till tomorrow, I'll have the answer. And then you run to your friends that night and say, does anyone know the answer? This is a man who doesn't believe he's a prophet. You can't have it both ways. You could be deluded, or you could be a forger. You could be neither one. You can't be both. You can't mix them. As I say, what you have is one group of people who will tell you, they assemble a lot of evidence, and they say, because the Quran is not a revelation, we have to explain these things. And they have a list of things they must explain. They say the only explanation for these things is the man was deluded. He thought he was a prophet. And another group of people say, because the Quran is not a revelation, we must explain these things. And they have a different list of things. And they say the only explanation for these facts is the man was a forger. He was a liar. He knew what he was doing, but he lied. These two groups don't get together to realize that you have to explain both lists of difficulties. You need this excuse here, and you need that excuse in this place, but you can't have both. To give you an example, the kind of circle that people go in, you ask somebody, what's the origin of the Quran? They tell you it came from the imagination of a man. But then you ask him, if it came from his head, where did he get his information? That is, the Quran talks about a lot of things which the Arabs didn't know about. If it came out of his head, how did that information get in his head? And then they'll tell you, well, maybe he wasn't crazy. Maybe he was a liar. Some foreigner brought him the information, so he lied. He told people he was a prophet. But then you have to ask them, if he was a liar, where did he get his confidence? Why did he behave as though he thought he was a prophet? And then they have to tell you, well, maybe he was crazy. He thought he was a prophet. And they start over and go round and round in this circle. As I've illustrated the one point, you have the information, like the wall of Dhul-Qarnayn. Who told this man about this place hundreds of miles to the north? Who told this man about embryology? And so on. When people assemble these facts, they have to assume that, well, somebody brought him the information and he used it to fool people. But now, if you assume that he was a liar, where did he get his confidence? Why is it that, for example, he told some people to their face what they would not say? That involves being convinced that you have a revelation. The Prophet had an uncle by the name of Abu Lahab, or that was his nickname, Abu Lahab. Here was a man who hated Islam, who used to follow the man around, he used to follow the Prophet around. If he saw him speaking to a stranger, he'd wait till they parted, and he'd go to the stranger and say, what did he tell you? Did he say black? It's white. That's how he thought. It was the opposite of what that man said. But about 10 years before this man died, before Abu Lahab died, the little surah, which is called Lahab, is in the Quran, and it says of this man, in just these few words it describes him, it says, in effect, he'll never change. He'll never be any different. For about 10 years, the Muslims could go to Abu Lahab and say, it has been revealed to us that you will never be a Muslim. All he had to do was say, well, I want to be a Muslim. How do you like that? What do you think of your revelation now? But he didn't do that. And yet, that's the kind of behavior you would expect from the man. He always said the opposite of what the Muslims said. See how dangerous that is from a human point of view. You're saying to somebody, you hate me? You want to finish me? Here, say these words and I'm through. Come on, say them! Say them! But he wouldn't do it. In order to put something like that in your book, you have to be convinced that you really have a revelation. when the Prophet fled from Mecca to Medina and he hid in the cave with Abu Bakr, they could see people coming to kill them. Abu Bakr was afraid. Now, if this man is a forger, somebody who lies to fool people, he's a prophet, what would you expect him to say when he sees people coming to kill him? You would expect he might say to his friend Abu Bakr, see if you can find a back way out of the cave. Or squeeze over in the corner and keep quiet. But in fact, what he said to Abu Bakr on that occasion was to relax. Don't worry. Because Allah is with us. He was confident. If you know that you're fooling people, where do you get this kind of attitude to say, oh, it's going to be fine? So as I say, you can go round and round in a circle, and people do. Because on the one hand, they may tell you Monday, Wednesday, Friday the man was a liar, and Tuesday, Thursday, Saturday they'll tell you that he was crazy. And you can't have it both ways, but they need both excuses to explain certain things. I had a minister in my home, that'd be about 7 years ago, and we were talking and the Quran was sitting on the floor with the title facing down, so he didn't know which book it was. And I just pointed to the book. I said, I have confidence in this book. Well, he looked, but he didn't know which book it was. He said, well, I'll tell you, if that's not the Bible, it was written by a man. So I said, let me tell you something about what's in that book. And in just 3 or 4 minutes, I told him a few things, nothing that I've mentioned here, it's something else, about what is in the Quran. And after 3 or 4 minutes, he said, you're right. He said, a man didn't write that book. The devil wrote it. So, which is unfortunate to have that attitude for many reasons. For one thing, that's a very quick and cheap excuse. There's a famous story that a report that is in the Bible. It talks about how some of the Jews were witnesses one day when Jesus raised a man from the dead. A man who'd been dead for 4 days, he said, get up. And the man came out of his tomb. And it says, some of the Jews who stood there and watched, what did they do? Did they say, it's a miracle. The man was dead, now he's alive. This is a true prophet. Some of the Jews said, no, it's the devil that did that, that raised him up. Now, this story is rehearsed very often in churches, and people cry big tears over that. They say, oh, if I'd been there, I wouldn't be so stupid as the Jew who would say that. I mean, a miracle, a dead man gets up. How could I say it was the devil? But they start to resemble those kinds of people if in 3 minutes you show them enough that all they can say is, oh, the devil did it. It's too much. Maybe the devil did, but that's a very quick decision to make. That's what the Meccans used to say, some of them. They said the devil brought in that. But just as with every other suggestion made, the Quran gives an answer. It says in one verse in particular, it says, do they say this came from Satan? Remind them of this. And it gives an argument in reply to that. There are many arguments in reply to that suggestion. For one thing, the Quran tells us that it says, when you read this book, you're supposed to be in the habit before you read this book to say, A'udhu billahi minash shaitanir rajim, which means, I take refuge in Allah from Satan, the rejected. Is this how Satan writes a book? He tells you, before you read my book, ask God to save you from me. That's very, very tricky. A man could write something like that, but can Satan do that? Can Satan put that in his book? Would God allow Satan to do that? Some people really show that they have a split mind on this. They'll tell you yes. On the other hand, these are the same people who will tell you that the devil is just that much less than God. Whatever God can do, probably the devil can do it too. Well, that's the attitude of somebody who says, this book is so surprising, no matter how good it is, the devil could do it. Muslims don't have that attitude. Satan may have his abilities, but they're a long ways separated from the abilities of Allah. It's a cheap and quick excuse. It should also bring us back to think about that verse I mentioned before. Even the devil should contradict himself when he writes. And the Quran says, if it didn't come from Allah, you should find some contradictions in this book. There's another attack sometimes made, or another direction that people come from. They may tell you that, well, your prophet was a liar and he was deceived, that is, he fooled himself. There's a name for that in psychology. They call it mythomania. It means you tell lies and then you believe them. You say, that's what he was. You see, he told lies, but then he believed his own lies. The problem with that idea is that mythomania cannot deal with facts. See, the Quran talks about facts, things you can go and look and see that they're true. The mythomaniac can't do that. Facts are a problem for him. The psychologist, the psychiatrist, tries to treat a man by confronting him with facts. If a man is mentally ill and he says, I'm the King of England, the psychologist doesn't say to him, you are crazy, you're not the King of England. He doesn't say that. He confronts him with facts. He says, you say you're the King of England? Tell me, where is the Queen today? Who is your Prime Minister? Bring me the army. Or something like that. So the man has trouble trying to deal with this. He has to make excuses. The Queen, she's visiting her mother. My Prime Minister, he resigned. He has to make excuses because the facts give him trouble. And this is how he's cured. If you keep putting enough facts in front of him, finally he faces the reality and realizes, I've been deluded. That's the way the Quran approaches everyone who reads it. There's an ayah which says, in these words there is a healing. Now this is part of the meaning of that. It's therapy. It heals crazy people. By telling them, you think this, you think that? Well, don't forget this. Have you considered such and such? That's the repeated kind of attitude throughout the Quran. It's saying, oh man, do you say so and so, but what about such and such? Oh man, have you said so and so, but didn't you also say this? How can you try that when you know this? It's always putting the facts in front of you, pushing your nose into what is relevant, what matters. So it heals you of your delusion. That's at least one aspect of the meaning of that verse. Maybe that has not always been as appreciated as it should be. There are, till now, some people who will tell you that the meaning of this verse is that there's medicine in the words of the Quran. Maybe. I know of a man who was quite ill, and so somebody took a page from the Quran and they poured water on it and they washed all the words off and they put the ink in a glass and they said, you drink this. It will heal you. Well, maybe. That would be one understanding of those words. I personally don't think so, but maybe. But certainly, people are healed of their craziness by the words of the Quran. It has, this type of thing, confronting people with the facts, has come to the attention of a lot of non-Muslims. In fact, you'll find an interesting reference in the New Catholic Encyclopedia. Now, here is the Catholic Church that has been around for so many centuries. The Quran is a problem for them. It says it's a revelation. So they study it. They would love to find proof that it isn't. They would love to find an explanation for what is it really. But they can't. At least the Catholic Church has been honest in its scholarship. They don't take the first quick excuse. In the New Catholic Encyclopedia, in the article on the subject of Quran, the church says that over the centuries many theories have been offered as to the origin of the Quran. And in their own words they say, today no sensible man accepts any of these theories. This leaves the Christian in some difficulty. See, listen carefully to what they're saying. They're saying for somebody who says the Quran came from here, it came from there, they have this idea, this theory. The church says in 14 centuries we still haven't heard a sensible idea. There is no sensible man that believes any of these suggestions as to the origin of the Quran. That's why they say it leaves the Christian in some difficulty. It leaves him in a lot of difficulty. He'd like to explain it, but he hasn't been able to yet. So that's maybe a second point I'd suggest, that when you meet someone who says, oh, the Quran came from here or there, they say, I can explain it. I have an idea where it came from. Tell him, go talk to the Catholic Church. They'd love to hear from you. They're waiting for an explanation. If you've got it, they might buy it from you. Because at least they've been honest enough to admit that in 14 centuries, they haven't found one yet. So it is not an easy thing to dismiss. Other groups of people have been a lot less honest than that. They'll quickly tell you, oh, the Quran, it came from here, it came from there, without examining that to see, is that thing at all possible, or can you explode it, push that away? In fact, most recently, the leading intellectual in the Catholic Church, Hans Küng is his name, he's been around for a lot of years, and he's highly respected in the church, sort of the intellect of the church today. Recently, after studying the Quran, he gave his opinion. He said, God has spoken to man through the man Muhammad. Now, that's his conclusion as the leading intellect in the Catholic Church. I don't think the Pope agrees with him. But this is what the leading intellect of the church says. Because he's facing the reality that it is not easily pushed aside, that in fact, God said these words. So as I say, if somebody has a better idea, they should go and talk to the church about it. Or they should find a new possibility. But I think that we have exhausted the possibilities. If the book is not a revelation, then it is a deception. And if it is a deception, what is its origin? And where does it deceive us? I'll come back to that in a moment. But I'd also like to point out that it may seem I'm discussing some things that there are surprising things you find in the Quran taken from ancient times, but there are surprising things found that have to do with our modern times. That is, the Quran is not an old problem, it's still a problem today. You have the interesting statement, for example, that it is the unbelievers who would take note of the fact that in the beginning the heavens and the earth were one piece, that all life is made of water. Well, that's what they awarded the 1973 Nobel Prize for. A couple of unbelievers talk about the origin of the universe, how it began from one piece, which they keep verifying till now. That life is made of water is probably, wouldn't have been a very easy thing to convince people of 14 centuries ago if you stood in the desert and told somebody, you see this is made of water, mostly it's water. That had to wait for the invention of the microscope to find out that cytoplasm, the basic substance of the cells, is 80% water. I mentioned falsification tests, chances to prove the Quran is incorrect. Some of those stand there just like the challenge to Abu Lahab. Some of them stand there today. In fact, you have an interesting ayah which says, speaking of the relationship not between individual people, but between groups of people. It's saying as a group, in effect, it says the Christians will treat you nicer than the Jews treat you, tells the Muslims that, as a group. Now, as I say, there have been a lot of Christians and a lot of Jews who have become Muslims. But as groups of people, this will generally be the case according to the Quran. Do you realize what that is? That's a chance for the Jews to prove that the Quran is false. All they have to do is get organized and treat the Muslims nicely for a few years. And then say, what does your book say about who is your best friend in the world? But I mean, really, who treats you the nicest? Jews or the Christians? Look what we Jews did for you. That's all I have to do. I haven't done it yet. But it stands there as a challenge, and you want to prove it's wrong? Do this. And as I mentioned, if somebody wants to insist that the Quran is a deception, then they have to show where the deception is. That is, it's a common theme that runs throughout the Quran time and time again. If the Quran says, do they say such and such? Let them bring their proof. You are never supposed to say something unless you bring the evidence. Do they say the Quran is a deception? Let them bring their proof. Show me one deception. Where does it deceive me? Show me a lie that it has told if you say it's a deception. Otherwise, don't say that unless you show me. It's not good enough to tell me. Show me. Now, I know that some people, they have some ideas about where the Quran has deceived the Muslim. But this just shows they haven't examined it very carefully. Maybe the Muslim hasn't examined it very carefully, in fact. We'll find, as an example, some Christians will say, well, where the Quran deceives you is, it tells you about all sorts of good things that you should do, but it lies to you. It tells you God doesn't have a son. Is that a lie that the Quran has told us? Well, as a matter of fact, the Quran does not forbid the Muslim to believe that God has a son. It doesn't say, the reason God doesn't have a son is because it's forbidden. It doesn't say that. It tells you why he doesn't have a son. It gives you the reason that God doesn't have a son, because. If when you say son you mean this, that can't be. You mean this when you say son, that can't be. You mean that? It exhausts all of the meanings of son to say each one of these can't be true of God for these reasons. So it doesn't forbid you from believing it. It tells you why. It doesn't lie to you. There's even an interesting verse that says the Muslim is supposed to repeat, if God has a son, I will be the first to worship him. So it's not telling you he doesn't. It's saying if he does, you should worship him. But in fact, he doesn't because of these reasons. So again, the deception is not an easy thing to find. Stress that to people. If they want to say the book deceives, let them show the lie they're talking about, which is the false thing it says. And don't be misled onto this kind of thing. I had that talk in Minnesota, in the U.S. a few months ago, and a man got very upset with a lot of things I had said, and so he started writing to me when I got home. And he said he had a whole book full of mistakes in the Quran. And he wasn't going to show me any of those because he said, you showed me mistakes in what I believe, but it doesn't change my belief. I still believe. He says, and you'd be the same way. If I showed you a mistake in what your book says, you'd still believe it. So I wrote him back to say, no, that's the difference between us. If you show me a mistake, I won't believe anymore. Because that's my attitude. I don't believe in spite of the difficulties. So I told him, I said, you pick the best mistake you can find. Tell me about it. What is the best mistake you can find? And what he wrote me was that the Quran says that Zechariah couldn't speak for 3 days, and the Bible says he couldn't speak for 9 months. So there's your mistake. Well, it's not so much a mistake as it is a matter of his book says this and my book says that. What remains to be proven is whose book is correct, which in fact can be demonstrated. But you see what I mean? It's not disagreement that is a problem. It's the actual proof. Somebody has to bring you the actual mistake, the case that will stand up in court to say this is false, but it's in your book. There's another way that a person can approach the Quran in examining the things that it has to say. I'll just illustrate this briefly. You can discover how surprising the book is by assembling what you might call a list of good guesses. See, the Quran talks about a lot of things. But I can explain it to you the way it works in mathematics. When you make guesses, if you have two choices, one is right, one is wrong, and you close your eyes and make a choice, half the time you'll be right. So you have a one in two chance. You could pick the wrong one, you could pick the right one. So one time out of two, you'll be right. But if you have two situations like that, I can be right or wrong about this, and I can be right or wrong about that, and I close my eyes and I guess like this, I'll only be right one time in four. It becomes one half times one half. That's because there's three ways to be wrong now. See, I can be wrong and wrong, or I can be wrong and right, or right and wrong. But the only way to be right is to be right and right. That's one out of the four possibilities. If you have three situations like that, and you make a blind guess three times, I'll guess this, and I'll guess that, and I'll guess this, you'll only be right one time in eight. say a half times a half times a half. Suppose that your options are 1 in 10. And you have another situation where there's 10 guesses, only one is right. 10 guesses here, only one is right. If you close your eyes and pick one, you're only going to be right one time in 100. 1/10 times 1/10. Because you've got 99 ways to be wrong and only one way to be right. So it is that if you draw up a list of the correct things the Quran has said, it becomes a very unlikely that these are all good guesses. If it has millions of ways to be wrong, but it's always right, then it's unlikely that somebody was guessing. I'll give you three examples that already make the odds 1 in 8. The Quran says about bees. It speaks of the bee which leaves its home for gathering food. And it says in this ayah that this bee is female. Now a person might guess on that, say, well, the bees that you see flying around, they could be male, they could be female, I think I'll guess female. He has a 1 in 2 chance of being right. So happens the Quran is right. It also so happens that's not what most people believed at that time. Can you tell the difference between a male bee and a female bee? It takes a specialist to do that anyway. But the male bee never leaves the home to gather food. In fact, in Shakespeare, in his play Henry IV, some of the characters are talking about bees, and they mention that the bees are soldiers and they have a king. That's what people thought in Shakespeare's day. They thought the bees you see flying, these are men, bees. And they go home and they answer to the king. That's not true. Those are female. They go home, they have a queen. But it took modern investigation in the last 300 years to realize that that's the case. The Quran is right. But it had a 50-50 chance of being right. But here's another situation where it could have guessed incorrectly. The Quran talks about the sun and how it travels through space. Now, if the sun is moving through space, there's at least two options. It could be traveling just as a stone would travel if you threw it, or it could be traveling with its own motion. The Quran says it has its own motion, uses a form of the word sabaha, which if you use that word and you talk about a man, if you say he did this yasba along the ground, you don't mean that somebody rolled him, you mean he's walking. If you say that of a man in water, you don't mean that he's floating, you mean he's swimming. If you say that of the sun, you don't mean that it's just flying through space, you mean it's turning as it goes through space. Well, the Quran says the sun turns. Is that an easy thing to discover? Can you tell the sun is turning? If you look at it, you can look for a second or two and you have to look away. You don't see any marks on it. You don't see anything after a few seconds. But in modern times, the equipment was made available to project the image of the sun down onto a tabletop so that you could look at it without being blinded. And then you see that after all, there are spots on the sun. And they move. And the sun turns once every 25 days. So it is turning. But that's a modern discovery. A lucky guess. But the odds are 1 in 4 about getting both of these guesses about the bees and the sun correct. And another indication would be to think back 14 centuries ago, people probably didn't understand about time zones. But back at home right now, my family's having breakfast. But it's dark here, and the sun just came up there. See, 14 centuries ago, a man could only travel about 35 miles a day. And if he traveled from India to Morocco, it took him months. And probably when he had supper in Morocco, he thought, back at home, they're having supper now in India. Because he didn't realize he has moved across the time zones. But the Quran is aware of that. It tells you in an interesting ayah, it says that when history finishes, when the judgment day arrives, it will happen in an instant. History ends in an instant. But it mentions that in that instant, it will catch some people in the daytime and some people in the nighttime. to which Muslim scientists have been aware for 14 centuries. They believed that. They said, well, at some time on the earth, it's day and night at the same time. That's not a thing that's obvious to your eyes or to your experience, but the Quran mentions that. So again, it's a good guess. And you can draw up a long list of good guesses, and the odds become very high that these are all guesses. To do this kind of thing is following in the best tradition of the Muslims, to investigate that way. The Quran expects this kind of challenge. You see, if I said to somebody, I pick out somebody here, I said, you, I know your father, I met your father. Probably he's in doubt. You just came here. How do you know my father? For all I know, he has no, his father is dead, for all I know. He's saying, how could you have met my father? Tell me, is he a tall man? Short? Bald? Does he have a beard? Does he wear glasses? Where did you meet him? But if I keep giving him all the right answers, finally he may say, I guess you know my father. I don't know how, but I guess you know him. The Quran is in the same situation. It says that it originates with the one who originated everything. So you have a right to say, convince me. If the author of this book really originated life, originated the heavens and the earth, he should know about this, he should know about that. Tell me something that proves you were there when life came to be. Do you know this? Do you know that? And that's what people have examined in every generation for 14 centuries. We all know something for sure. We don't have to be an expert on something in an academic field. I mentioned to you when I started, the sailor. What he knows is his experience. He knows what a storm is like on the ocean. Everybody knows something. They have a right to say, I wonder, does the author of the Quran know that thing? For myself, because of my field in mathematics and logic, there's a very delicate point which caused quite a bit of excitement only 100 years ago among mathematicians. It occurred to me the author of the Quran should know about that. It would take too much explaining to go into it, but I checked and he did. It's there in the Quran. But it's a development of the last 100 years in logic. We all know something, and it should be there. The answer should be there. We should be ready to give an account to justify ourselves. That's the meaning of iman. Iman is not properly translated faith, which usually means in English, faith means a promise to believe something even though it seems it must be impossible. You believe it without evidence, that's faith. Iman is not that. The root meaning of that word means confirmation, emunah. It means when you check on something. You believe it because you looked and you saw indications that it was true. Doesn't mean necessarily you prove every item, but you looked and you see, this agrees with what I know so far. You've thought about it, so your iman grows. And you're supposed to do that all your life. I'm afraid that Muslims very often don't have the confidence to deal with these things. And yet you have the ayah in the 25th surah, the 33rd ayah, where it says, there is no question that they bring you, but we give you the best answer and the explanation of it. So whatever question they have, the answer is in the Quran. I have mentioned in 7 years of giving lectures in various places that I have basically only heard 35 questions. Now, I've heard hundreds of people ask questions, but I've heard about 35 different questions. That's all. The Quran says, no matter which question they bring you, we give you an answer. People have a long ways to go. It's an interesting thing you'll find if you look in the index of the Quran. This is an index of every word in the Quran, al-Muwajjim al-Mufahris. It's what you should expect to find, according to this ayah. It says, for every question they bring you, we give you an answer. Allah says the answer is here. If you look up the word in the index, qalu, it means they say. You'll find it's in the Quran 332 times. 332 times the Quran says, they say such and such. And if you look up the word kul, which is the command say, you'll find it's in the Quran 332 times. Of everything they say, you tell them this. 332 is a long ways from 35. There's a lot of questions people haven't even bothered to ask. The Quran has the answers. And it's not that big of a book, about 80,000 words, which is supposed to offer you the reply to what somebody says. By way of advice, I suggest if you're going to take up this kind of activity to arm yourself with a knowledge of the Quran and the answers it gives, there's a number of things to keep in mind. Be very careful that you are considering the original wording of the Quran. I don't know of any translation in any language that doesn't contain some mistakes in the translation. Or if not mistakes, it does not make the point clearly enough, as in the Arabic. Now, that's not to say every Muslim has to learn Arabic, but that is to say that the real answer to a lot of problems is contained in the Arabic. You will find a lot of examples of this kind of thing, which even when Muslims translate. That's one of the things that surprised me about the Quran, was how consistent the author is in his choice of words. If he tells a story one way, he doesn't trip himself up in another place by telling it in a different way. Don't be fooled by this kind of thing. We have in Toronto a group of people whose mission in life is to convert Muslims away from Islam. And the Muslims always go to the lectures that they put on. They find it very entertaining, in fact. And recently, a man gave a talk and he was explaining how, he said, you know, if you Muslims paid more attention to the Quran, you might be Christians. Because look what the Quran says here about Jesus. It says he is ayat lil alameen, a sign to all the worlds. Do you see that? It doesn't say that about your prophet. But it says of Jesus, he's ayat lil alameen. Think about that. You might be a Christian. So a friend of mine asked when the question period came, he said, I want to sort out the confusion. You said that because I read that Jesus was ayat lil alameen, I should be a Christian. What should I be when I read in the Quran in this place where it says Pharaoh, Firaun, was ayat lil alameen? Which religion will that lead me to? Because it says the same thing about Pharaoh. The exact same words describe Pharaoh as describe Jesus in this case. They're very different kinds of people, of course, but they have this in common. But if you're not aware of that, a person can be fooled in this way. The man who said this probably knew that, but hoped that the Muslims didn't. Or maybe he didn't know. Doesn't matter, he'll keep using it. I know this man, and that's his reputation. You see, by way of a second piece of advice, both a Muslim and a non-Muslim, if you're going to investigate something, take the advice that the scientific community gives now. They tell a young man who's starting out to investigate, he's newly out of university maybe, or in university, and he wants to make a career being a scientist in some field. And the advice they offer him is, get hold of a theory and defend it, even if it's false. Defend it, if you can. Because if it's false, eventually you won't be able to defend it. But at least it's been thoroughly tested, and you've made progress. You know this one is false. You see, you have to investigate Islam in the same way. Investigate it as though you were a Muslim, and somebody's challenging you. Can you answer what he says? See, the mistake so many people make is they tell you they investigate Islam, but they didn't want Islam in any sense. So their attitude is the first thing they can find that makes Islam look bad, there's what I needed, this is my excuse. And they reject Islam. But to really make progress, you have to deal with it as though you were on the inside. It was the attitude I took, because believe me, there are all kinds of books that criticize Islam. But it occurred to me, well, what do Muslims say about these things? If there's all these criticisms, why is anybody a Muslim? Maybe the Muslims have answers to these things. And in fact, they do. Some of the answers have been around for 14 centuries. It doesn't matter. People keep using the same excuses. In fact, it was only a few months ago somebody handed in a question to me on paper after a talk. They said, what about this mistake in the Quran, where it says that the mother of Jesus was the sister of Aaron? So that's a confusion. Miriam has been confused with Miriam. Miriam was the sister of Harun. Miriam lived hundreds of years later and was the mother of Jesus. So your book has a mistake in it. See, for 14 centuries, the Muslims have explained, no, this word here translated in this way does not necessarily mean a sister. It means a woman from that family. It means she was descended from the family of Aaron. It's a figure of speech. You say sister of Aaron, you mean from the family of Aaron. Not necessarily literally Aaron. No, no, no. Some missionary groups will tell you, it's a mistake. Well, if they want to call it a mistake, be my guest. Do you know that the Bible says, on the subject of Elizabeth, the mother of John the Baptist, the mother of Yahya, it says she was the daughter of Aaron. You tell them that, and they say, no, no, no. You see, daughter doesn't mean daughter. It means great, 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 great granddaughter. That's an example of, you see, taking the first thing that looks like it will work, instead of finding out, does it really work? I'll tell you one last story along those lines, which has gone out over a period of about 3 years now. About 3 years ago, the man who was the head of this missionary group in Toronto said, at a public meeting, he said, there's a serious mistake in the Quran. In the place where it says, the Jews boasted, we killed the Messiah. He said, the Jews would never say that. A Jew would never say, I killed the Messiah. They're waiting for the Messiah. They wouldn't say, we killed the Messiah. Your book is wrong. So it was pointed out to him that this was sarcasm. That the Quran also says that the Meccans used to come to the Muslims and say to them, you to whom the revelation came, tell us something. It didn't mean the Meccans believed that the revelation came to these people. They were teasing them. The Bible says that the Jews said to Jesus when they crucified him, they said, save yourself, Messiah. They didn't say false Messiah. They said, Messiah, save yourself. Come down from there. So they teased him. They were sarcastic when they said Messiah. And that's all the Quran talks about. It didn't matter to this man. 2 years later, one of his students came to a talk that I gave. Came to me after, he said, you know, there's a serious mistake in the Quran. And he brings up this same argument. I said, 2 years ago I told your teacher this, and I gave him the reply. He put out his hand, you want to shake my hand? He said, okay, I'll give you that. He said, that's a silly argument. But I asked him, then why did your teacher still use it 2 years later? Because he doesn't care if it works or not, he hopes it will fool somebody. Some people think that way. They use as justification a scripture passage which says, if I tell a lie, but it glorifies God, I'm not a sinner. Some people believe that. That's what they think that verse means, and that justifies lying for the sake of the truth. You can imagine such a thing. Some people. Other people don't. As I said, I've had some fine people come to me, representatives of church groups, who've asked me for names and addresses of people who say this because they're angry and say, I'll stop him if I can, because they care about truth. Finally, only a couple of months ago, this same man had a meeting, and in the question period, I brought up this same point. So this argument you've been using for 3 years at least, it's false for these reasons, and I want everyone to know that. And it embarrassed him very much, but he said, I still don't think a Jew would ever say that. So at this point, somebody put their hand up. And he was anxious to get away from this discussion, so he quickly said, yes, yes. The man spoke up and he said, last week in this room, there was a rabbi giving a lecture on religion. And when the question period came, I asked him, what do Jews say about the Messiah? And he laughed and said, well, we Jews killed the Messiah. So there you are. It's on tape. There are eyewitnesses here. Once there was a rabbi, he said those words, we Jews killed the Messiah. I don't think it will matter to the man. 3 years from now, he'll probably still use the argument. It doesn't work. So by way of advice and suggestion, you may hear a lot of difficulties that people try to bring up. But examine it and remind them they should examine it. The task of the Muslim is not to win people away from their religions. The Muslim doesn't go around saying, you shouldn't be that, you should be this. You should leave that and come to Islam. That's not really the Muslim's job. The Muslim says, you, whichever religion or belief you have, should be more careful. Don't commit excess. Don't say more than you have the right to say. Because the Muslim believes that if a person will do this, if he'll make sure of what he says, eventually he'll come to Islam. But that's the starting point. So I thank you for your time and attention and patience. May Allah guide us always closer to the truth. Alhamdulillah. I'll take questions.